Please roll the tape for us. This is the first of five Bible studies that I'll be doing this week on Advent hope. And my name is Peter Nash. I teach at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, which is a United Methodist seminary. Wrong vignette. In Evanston, Illinois. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Dear God, we stop for these moments to remember that we spend every moment of our existence in your presence. You have given us riches beyond our comprehension. Each element of your creation you nurture as a child. Make us mindful that we need our older brothers and sisters in your creation. Teach us to care for them as they have cared for and provided for us. These things we ask in the name of your Son. Having grown up in Michigan and living in Illinois, it is very difficult to see a Washington Rose Bowl shirt. It's real shock. What do you think of when you think of Advent? What comes to mind? Pardon?
Anticipation.
Okay. I don't talk in full sentences, so I don't see any need for anybody else to, but I try to write in full sentences, but that's only because editors and dissertation advisors are picky. What else? Christmas.
Waiting.
Hymns you can't sing. You don't have to write that.
That is the whole Lutheran hymn, LBW, as far as I'm concerned. Ron said, hymns that you can't sing. Well, maybe if we'd sing them more often, we'd get accustomed to them. Anything else?
Candles? Verses or stories or?
Verses. Or passages maybe, but the scripture itself, not just the story.
All right. What other things? We've done pretty much church stuff. How about around the house?
Baking.
This is one of the things I was always waiting for was my grandmother, who was a cook, was a great baker. We didn't get the smells at our house, but boy, Christmas Eve or a couple of days before, we got a big package. Very happy. I don't know, for some people that means the smells around the house.
Fucking commercial is that?
What?
I don't know if that's the right word, but attempting to run against commercialism at home during that period.
Well, you said bucking, right?
Mm-hmm.
The advent calendars.
The ones with the little chocolates in
them. Scratches.
Scratches.
Well, I can celebrate with you guys.
Lessons?
Presents?
Yeah, if you have kids, you start with waiting.
We're not a space here, so if you got one, get it in.
Some relatives.
Shall I underline some?
Underline three times.
Okay, on that note, move on to something a little less humorous. Something I wrote. Just get through all complete sentences. These are the things, many of the things, not all of the things, that come to mind when we get past Thanksgiving into that party season that we all enjoy and dread at the same time. For lots of different reasons, because not all of the relatives we want to see we get to see. Some of them that we don't particularly want to see, we do see. We do tend to party nonstop from Thanksgiving to Christmas, and we dread getting on the scale on January 1st after the Rose Bowl. There's smells that bring back memories. There are all kinds of, we look at the Sunday paper beginning about the middle of October now and notice how much fatter it is. And so when it comes the first Sunday after Christmas and we can pick it up, we're shocked. Talking about the commercialism, all that happens, all the things that people want to tell us that we need or that will make us happy, that will fill the sense of anticipation for us. Make us fulfilled if we just buy the right, and you fill in the blank, perfume, car, sweater, shoes, toy. That's what's going to make us happy in this time. That's what we're anticipating. As we have this season that becomes the long Christmas season, and we hope for something that I think in many cases or in many parts of our lives or during periods of our lives, it comes and goes, I think, with most of us, when we don't really know what it is that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. We're hoping for something, but we're not quite sure what it is.
I think you also become more reflective. You know, you think of past Christmases. Mm-hmm. And
right, yeah. I mean, lots of memories. That's why I put the smells up there. I know that the baking brings smells. Last Christmas, for presents for our daughter's teachers, we made cookies, and we made chocolate chip cookies, which is what Carrie and I make almost every Saturday. And then we made sugar cookies, which are the cookies that my mom made with us. Then we make cookies that my grandma, some fudge drops that my grandma made, and was always one of the ones that was always in that package that we waited for. Well, let me just tell you one story about that package. When I was on internship in Philadelphia, so about 1,000 miles away from home, my grandmother sent me the cookies, which were for the kid in me, and she sent me some cologne for the grown up in me.
Oh, great grandma.
But she didn't know the grown up in me liked being a different sort of smelly and never used cologne and was really looking forward to the cookies. Unfortunately, the U.S. Postal Service, for which I have tremendous respect, my dad worked for them for years and years, found a way to break the perfume. So I had about 20 cookies that smelled like this wretched cologne that I would have never worn anyway. I actually ate some of that cologne, hoping that just one of these cookies would be edible, but it didn't work out that way. But we do remember at Christmas time, both usually the good, but also some of the bad things that have taken place during the year. We all know that, my grandmother died this March, and she lived with my aunt and uncle for nearly 30 years. It's going to be a very, very difficult time for my aunt. It's going to be a difficult time for all of us, but in the year, the first set of holidays after someone passes, there are memories that come back and enliven us in some ways and sadness in others. One of the things that we left out here is that, and I think you're maybe getting at it, is that the mood sort of elevates across the country. People do nice things. People who never did a nice thing for you in your life suddenly do something nice for you just because it's Christmas time. You know, maybe the boss doesn't yell when you're late because the kid was giving you a hard time on the way out the door for school. but the mood seems to change. I want to start by reading an introduction to a piece that I've done for the ELCA Studies Office in the Division for Social Ministry. They've written, for those of you who are pastors, I don't know how they're going to distribute this stuff, but sometime soon you should be getting a packet, in one of those packets of ELCA mail-ins, an Advent study and an Advent Epiphany and so on, text study for that focuses on peace, justice, and care of the earth. And I wrote the Advent part for it, and I'm going to share the introduction today and then the individual text parts along the way. The church year begins with a season of anticipation. We believe that God will act in an overwhelmingly gracious manner, and we long for that redemptive act. In the West, we can learn from our children who believe that Christmas morning will bring wonders beyond belief. We can also teach our children that these marvelous gifts cannot be purchased at Sears or Walmart. Many of us have avoided references to Western or U.S. American Christmas because we believe it has become such a secular phenomenon. We fear the syncretism that places Santa, no longer even a saint, before Jesus. This is a legitimate concern. Nevertheless, this is the one time during the church year when the theme of the church leads the mood of the culture. Corrupted as the images of the commercial season may be, they are primarily images drawn from Christian sources. One of the things we can reclaim during this season is a sense of the eternal within the temporal. Our claims about eternity are valid, but they are only valid if we recognize the God of the church as the God who created earth and the heavens and all they contain. Otherwise, we have no place in God's eternity. We are not real. Like the inhabitants of ancient Olympus, we are mythological figures without time or space. Outside of time and space, God too becomes merely an abstraction, an unsubstantiated hope. God is real when God is present in each moment. We can also reclaim the hope that faith is a gift for the living of life in this world. It is neither a talisman to ward off evil circumstances, nor is it simply a bridge to the next life. Faith allowed the ancient Israelites to endure despair. Martin Buber recognized Israel's murmurings in the wilderness and the rantings of Job as acts of faith. Dissatisfaction laid at the feet of the one who had the power to change and the will to forgive and to restore. We can regain the sense that God is concerned with the quality of life on earth. We have a somewhat justifiable tendency based upon part of Scripture to place ourselves on the top of the moral order. We do this, of course, both as groups and as individuals. The accompanying assumptions that God therefore cares more for us than for non-Christians or even for other elements of creation and is pleased that we have control of so much of the world and use it for our own benefit is not wholly supported by Scripture. The words of Jesus remind us that God is very concerned with every detail of our lives, but in doing so, he reminds us that God is also concerned with all of the elements of creation, even the pesky sparrows. Our authority may be greater than theirs, based on our greater skills, but our rights are not. There are limits to human dominion. The ancient belief that the world was floating on water under a great dome of water was, while scientifically naive, very helpful for for curbing the explorer-exploiter mentality which served to build the western part of this country. Ancient technology set limits that were far too confining by our standards. Conservation of resources was a necessity for life. We, on the other hand, have come to believe that there are no limits or that they do not apply to individuals. We push forward, always believing that we will be able to find new, clean, resource-rich land, or that technology will find a way to rescue us from our own waste. We have become so accustomed to our resource-intensive lifestyles that we have begun asking the Southern Hemisphere to delay its own industrialization, in part to allow the rainforest to act as an air filter for northern industry. Just an aside here, I saw a cartoon that had a guy, big, huge guy, labeled industrialized West, puffing on a cigar, speaking to a small peasant man labeled Southern Hemisphere. And the words in the caption were, "Think of yourself as the Airwick of the world." The imagery of this Advent's lessons are vivid. The agricultural imagery is consistent with the Israelite tradition that saw God's hand in every living thing and led natural theologians to look for God in nature. The fig tree informs us of the coming seasons. Likewise, there are natural indications of the coming of the Messianic Age. There is an underlying assumption in the old natural parallels of the Mashal that humankind is but one part of creation and not even an irreplaceable one, as we often assume. This is a counterweight or balance to the high anthropology of Psalm 8. Twice this Advent, once from the mouth of Jesus and once from the mouth of John the Baptizer, we are struck by the realization that the very rocks are able to praise God if humans fail to do so. Does it strike any chords or raise any ire or just prompt any comments? That doesn't mean I got it all right. Let's look at Isaiah 55, which is not one of the Advent texts this year, but gosh, do I wish it was. In this question of what are we anticipating, what event are we anticipating, what are we hoping for, what is the second coming going to bring, what were the expectations and what are our expectations? This is one of the places that I continue to gravitate, as is usual the case with me on both a serious and humorous aside at the same time, this was the passage on the cover of our wedding bulletin, you can see how naive we were when we entered into that particular covenant with one another, especially in the first couple of lines when they talk about buying without money.
Credit cards.
Yeah. At least one commentator thinks that the beginning language here is the language of an advertiser, in this case a barker, someone in the souk, in the market, calling people in to buy what he has to sell. I've been talking for an hour now. Can I get someone else to read the first five verses here? In Isaiah 55. Please.
Ho, everyone who, now this is the New Revised Standard Version, by the way. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you that have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread,
and your labor for that which does not satisfy. Listen carefully to me and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen so that I may live. I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. See, I made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. See, you shall call nations that you do not know, and nations that do not know who shall run to you, because of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you.
Okay, thank you. Let me just say briefly about the period in which this was written, and what some of the hopes were for these people. This is what we generally call Second Isaiah, written at the end, just at the end of the exile. It begins with the words, "Comfort, comfort ye my people," that the punishment of the exile is finished, and now these folks are ready and have begun to return to Israel. They've been without a king, without a homeland for about 70 years. And in that period, we begin to see the development of a theology that in my classes I call expanding your God and exploding your mind, or blowing your mind. Because they've, in some cases, had a God in a box theology. They knew where God lived. They knew God's address, and they could go talk to God whenever they wanted to, and God cared for them in a way that God didn't care for anyone else on the earth. With the loss of the temple in Jerusalem, with the loss of a king, the loss of a homeland, the things promised in the covenant, in many of the covenants, they had to restructure their God, and God begins to be more universal. So that even the Persian king Cyrus can be called the Messiah, the one who is empowered to deliver. And so there's a change going on in the theology. And the question then is, what satisfies? You know, what's going to satisfy people? And I'd like to bring that question forward for us today. What are we spending our money on that doesn't satisfy us? I'll confess first. Nobody else has to confess, but I'll just give you an example from my life. Writing is a very important part of my life. If I don't write, I don't eat, basically. And if I don't write well, I don't keep my job. So I've tended to buy things like computers that hold more data, give me my data back faster once I've put it in there and have to look for it for several days. And very nice fountain pens, with the idea, apparently, somewhere in the back of my mind, if I can get the right writing tools, I can write better. Because God knows I'm not going to sit down and work hard at writing. It just doesn't work that way. It's the tool, right? It's what you write with that makes it. I mean, that's what they tell me in the ads. If I buy this computer, everything will go faster. And if I use this pen, boy, it will be a joy to write. Well, there's no such thing as a joy to write, not with any pen. But that's the kind of thing for me that it's easy to look at the pictures for some reason in my mind, in my where I'm oriented, to look and say, if I buy this, I'll be satisfied. And oddly enough, no computer is ever good enough, and no pen ever makes it a joy to write. But I keep buying them, you know. Keep spending my money on that which does not satisfy. How do we do that today? What are we hoping for, and what are we spending our money on?
Bigger homes.
Bigger homes? Yeah. Sometimes you have to get a bigger home, right? You have a bigger family, you gotta move up some way, or at least build out. But there's a joke among people who tell us how to organize our lives. Never buy a bigger desk, because all you do is fill it up. we tend to buy houses when we run out of bigger houses because we run out of place to put all the stuff that we bought and turned out not to satisfy us.
Wall furniture.
Stereo equipment.
Stereo equipment. I said you didn't have to confess here.
Fitness centers and diet centers.
Both.
Business.
Big business, promising us what?
The perfect you.
The perfect you. Mm-hmm. I would add a TH there at the end. The perfect youth, you know, eternal youth, that we're not going to age, that we can, that it's not, Raquel Welch doesn't look the way she looks because, in large part, because of genetics. But everybody can look that kind of great, whether or not you looked that kind of great when you were 16.
Now, I don't think we should be so critical of ourselves because a lot of those things actually do bring some satisfaction. You get a good stereo system and now I can sit there with my CD player and lay with my head between the speakers and that's very satisfying.
You got an amen in the back row there.
Services. We spend a lot of money on services from other people. Cleaners, child care, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, it's work that was originally done within the household.
Okay.
So we're paying someone else to do that so that we can do something else, which may or may not satisfy us.
Yeah. Buying time, in a sense, more time is going to make us happier. I don't want to take this too lightly, though, even though she did go to Washington. I agree. Far be it from me to criticize the fitness emphasis. The fitness craze is what I have a problem with. The number of rowing machines and stationary bicycles that are really stationary, that are no more than clothes racks that we bought them in. And then even those of us who do use them and we get some sense of satisfaction on them, but then our body ceases to be the temple and becomes the object of worship.
And then you can't ride the darn thing unless you've got the proper outfit. You know,
yeah.
The pants are like a second skin.
Yeah, God forbid someone should see me riding in my bedroom looking sloppy.
Well, it's kind of set up that way. I mean, the advertisers set it up that way. I mean, you buy stereo equipment and 3 years later you can't get that one fixed. You mm-hmm. got to buy something with a memory on it. And then the next year, if something goes wrong with that, then you have to buy something with a memory and a retriever. And it just goes on and on and on. I mean, with a lot of stuff, you know, with clothes and everything. You just can't.
When you keep breaking your stuff, Ron.
This stuff is made to wear out, so you have to buy it. You have to throw away.
But isn't that a recognition of the fact that it does not satisfy?
Yeah.
Add one more thing on, that then you'll think, well, that didn't satisfy, but one more thing, maybe that one will.
Yeah.
I think for me, a lot of the confusion comes in that whole notion about being satisfied. And my big struggle is remembering that I'm never going to be satisfied. And not only in terms of material goods, but in terms of relationships too. I mean, all those people that love me fail me all the time. And I really get angry about it. And I'm never satisfied. Mm-hmm. I'm always unhappy. And that's my nature. And what I long for just all the time is I want to be loved and accepted and appreciated. That's what I long for. And it never really happens.
Yeah, well, let's go home.
I think our expectations are too high.
How do you mean our expectations are too high?
Well, you know, why should I expect all of you to appreciate me?
Uh-huh. Right?
Are you from the Midwest?
Not original. Lately. But I really think I've been working in early childhood, and the big question of how do you give children high self-esteem is a major, major issue mm-hmm. with early childhood educators. And, you know, looking through that, I just feel like
this is crazy. You can't get your self-esteem from other people because other people are going to do what she's saying. They're all cosmetic surgery because mm-hmm. you didn't come right. You know, who comes right? There are about 1 in 10 million people who look like Rockwell Welsh. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think she's deformed.
You're not jealous now, are you?
But I remember Twiggy was important 3 years ago, now she's out.
Yeah.
And just think if she had had all this cosmetic surgery available to her.
I wonder if in the days of the old masters, you know, do you ever look at these old...
The Rubens and so on.
They're all big, flabby...
The Rubens.
You can
be a Rubens.
Yeah.
You know, we need new advertising.
Absolutely.
It seems to me that what Nancy said, that this dissatisfaction in the time of Goethe would have been seen as the epitome of the human, namely to always be dissatisfied. Striving was for him the most lofty definition of human life, because it can be sublimated into poetry. We have no poetry because we try to satisfy everything on the surface. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't lead to that closest to the divine. I doubt that God satisfies us ultimately either. Mm-hmm. At least God leaves me disappointed, left Job very disappointed and bitterly complaining. And I think that's because God, unlike these commercial advertisers, realizes that we reach our highest when we're not satisfied by all of this crap. And we keep searching. And our love disappoints us and causes us to look for a deeper love. That seems to be a definition of life. So the church, I think, should get into the advertising business of saying, be delighted that you're not satisfied into some kind of smug stasis where you no longer strive.
Yeah. The advertising's come up 3 times, and one of the things I want to point out there is advertising and dissatisfaction. We do realize, of course, that there's a whole army of well-paid men and women who have as their job in life to make sure that you and I are dissatisfied. And then to convince us, once we're dissatisfied, if we're not already, that what they have is what's going to satisfy us.
Like the Absolute Vodka, I love that one, don't you?
Yeah.
And now I saw, it must have been some of my daughter's friends, I don't think it would have been my daughter, although she is drinking age, but in the kitchen, one of the Absolute, I think it's a Swedish aquavit or some vodka or something like that. I need to admit that, but I think the Swedes are important. And now it's not just the Absolute Vodka, but the Absolute Citron. Hmm. And Citron, if I'm not mistaken, means lemon, so you get the ultimate lemon. I think that's a beautiful irony.
That's where I started with the advertiser at the beginning. Hey, all you, and it really sounds like what you're going to hear on television. I used the example in the first Bible study of, some people have always said I'm off balance, and now it's proved. In the Midwest, when they first started advocating nuclear power, they told us that it was going to be so cheap that they wouldn't be able to meter it. And what is that trend? Well, if you can't meter it, right, you can't charge it. Well, then explain to me, why is it in northern Illinois, with 4 nuclear generators running, we have if we're not the top, we're within the top 3 of electric energy costs. And this stuff's going to be so cheap that you can't meter it. And it's not all because of the crazy Holden protesters. There are considerable other problems that... have made nuclear energy very expensive. At any rate, that's not the point. The point is that they promised something that they knew from the beginning that they couldn't deliver, and we willingly took like sheep to the slaughter, followed along, because we want to believe that we can get something for nothing. We want to believe that there's something out there that's going to satisfy us ultimately. So when these men and these women write these clever ads about the absolute or the ultimate driving machine or this or that, we line up with our money to buy which does not satisfy us. I mean, you drink, if you buy that vodka, it's going to be gone in some households in a week and other households in a year, but you're going to empty the bottle. You buy that car, sooner or later you're going to trade it in, right? Or have it foreclosed upon in my income bracket, have it repossessed. but they're out there. But this text says that, you know, claims to have what we need. And not only does it have what we need, but we can't buy it. Or we can't buy it in the old way. We can't buy it with cash. Let's go on. Someone read 6 through 9 for me.
Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord that he may have mercy on him. And to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so may the ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. True 9?
Yes, thank you. A couple things come up here. And the Morning Bump study summit looked at the passage. What does it mean, seek the Lord while he may be found? And another person responded, that doesn't sound very Lutheran. But I think there is a sense of urgency to be heard here. That there are particular moments in our lives when we can make connections that we will otherwise miss. They may come around again. They will come around again, but we'll be in it will have an entirely different effect upon our lives. And if one is seeking God, see God where God is the point here. Recognize that God is present and make the connection as best you are able. Does that make any sense? Make enough sense for me to go on from it. The other piece I want to pick up on here is that Nancy mentioned this eternal dissatisfaction. I think the only way it is satisfied is through forgiveness. What Isaiah offers us in this text is forgiveness, ultimate forgiveness from the one that we claim has that power, which then in turn gives us the ability to forgive ourselves and to forgive those around us. It's when we're striving to be perfect, and I don't have anything against striving per se, but it's when we're striving to fulfill it all ourselves that we get so angry at other people because they don't let us do it. The relationships with them don't let us then be perfect as long as we're thinking that we're going to make it ourselves. The forgiveness that comes to us enables us first to forgive ourselves and then I think to forgive others for the things that once we realize that we too are disappointing our loved ones all along the way. God comes and says, yes, you've disappointed me, nevertheless I will forgive. And that enables us to make the same action. Am I making sense? Are you still awake, Paul?
Another word in that passage is actually in the former of the two that we read that is very meaningful to me is what God promises in verse 3, an everlasting covenant, certainly essentially related to what you said about forgiveness. In other words, what's promised is not all of our needs fulfilled, but rather a relationship that won't go away. And I guess that would be the highest hope I'd have of my marriage, that there'd be a lot of crap that's exchanged from both sides, but it won't go away. Hang in there, and if you then sprinkle that generously with forgiveness, that's a pretty wonderful hope.
In 8 and 9, though, God is wagging his finger again like he did at Job.
Say some more about God wagging his finger here.
Oh, and God spoke to Job from whirlwind thing, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth and so forth. He's telling us, you know, don't presume too much.
I think there is a similarity here. I ask you to say something because I didn't see it initially. But Job's very sin here, or the only sin that we can even that I can even infer from Job, is the lack of humility. Mm-hmm. And his constant cry is, I've done it according to the traditional wisdom of Israel, Egypt, and Mesopotamia. He doesn't say it like that, but he is cast over and over again in responding to the traditional wisdom literature of the ancient Near East, the wisdom that tells one how to live rightly and therefore to receive all of the benefits of life. If you do A, then B will follow. It's one strain of the wisdom tradition in the ancient Near East. And the friends come in and they tell Job, well, you must have sinned somewhere. And Job says, no, I haven't. I haven't done this, and I haven't done that, and I haven't done that. And he ticks off all the friends tick off possibilities, and he says, no, I haven't done them. And when God appears near the end of the book, then it is the question he gives God is, it gives Job is, how do you know what is right, basically?
Can you explain what connection exists between 8 and 9 and what went on? Apparently the 4 would suggest that it's going to explain some aspect of what went before, and I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. So in 3, which you looked at before, where there's an everlasting covenant, and David then in 4 is a witness, then you get down here in 8 and 9 with, you don't really understand?
Yeah, what it's explaining with the 4, apparently it's coming in and saying that you shouldn't seek what doesn't satisfy, rather you should be longing for the everlasting covenant, and depending on God, and you should be obedient, you should depend on God for forgiveness, because God's ready to give it. And then the explanation in 8 and 9, what's that explaining about what went before?
I'm still not sure I'm quite with you, but...
Yeah, I take it the 4 means, now I'm going to explain something that went before.
Well, I think that that's a reference to David as the as an example of God's steadfast love.
You mean when you not say first. 4? You mean the word 4? F O R.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm
sorry.
Because
key. Key. Thank you.
Those people will Hebrew.
Well, I leave David behind and catch up with you here.
Seems to indicate that 7 is something unexpected. That verse 7 contains something unexpected. Mm-hmm. That evil people should turn to God and receive a pardon.
I think it's the explanation here is that God is able to forgive far beyond anyone's capacity to hope for forgiveness. Indeed, my ways are not your ways. You know, the way that you understand is someone slaps you, you slap back. You have the goel, the person who, if there's an offense against my family, someone, the goel, the redeemer, the vindicator, is obliged to go and equal the offense. To keep a balance in the broader community. God say, no, I don't work that way.
So expect the unexpected because of God.
Yeah.
I think maybe it also becomes an invitation to God's way of thinking, reflecting on last night's sermon, a new way of seeing things. And to see my dissatisfaction usually comes from the fact that I'm expecting that which has never been promised in the first place. And I've taken that upon myself, and in a sense made myself God. I promised myself what I want, and here God invites me to hear the promise and to see things from where God is seeing things and not from my lowly position.
That, of course, is sort of the basis of all sin, to make ourselves God, to go for that which is not in our place to provide. We've got so much around here. Let's go back to the story, the Eden story. We have a garden in which everything is given that we need, and for some dumb reason, we say, well, this looks good too. I think I'll have a bite of this. I think I'll have this and share it with my friend over here, who also doesn't need it.
Just going back to Advent again, you know, we hear these statistics about more suicides and the depression and everything around family holidays like Christmas.
Right.
And it's certainly that expectations are we're going to have this marvelous time, and then we don't have this marvelous time.
Or even we have a marvelous time and still I don't get together with my girlfriend or back together with my wife, or my kids still talk back to me in the midst of it, or so even though I had some fun, life still goes on the same way. Something I want to get at through today especially, but through the week, is that there is this expectation that life is easy. That I can't find substantiated anywhere in scripture or any of the great literature of the world, except as an ideal. But whenever the stories are about real people, it's difficult. Life is difficult. But we have this picture. Maybe I should just speak personally. I have this picture that life is going to float along. That I'm going to start something and I'm going to finish it. That my kids are going to be not only perfect, but more perfect than I am. They're going to do the things that I never did. That I'm going to be a better dad than my dad was. We moved it from, I guess, from perfection a few generations ago to evolution. Kind of the step up, everything gets better. And now we've got a very angry, approaching middle class that understands, my goodness, I may never be able to buy a house, even as nice a house as my parents had. Because we've grown up expecting things to be easy. Not without trouble, but easy. That there's a natural progression, and we're gonna keep getting better.
But and I don't talk that.
Yeah, we are taught that.
We are taught that in Sunday school and Bible scriptures that ministers and teachers choose to teach us on Sunday morning. We're taught that if we pick the right man, we'll have a perfect marriage and perfect children and the hat and gloves and high heel shoes and the kids will go to college and we're taught
that. Yeah. We're taught in a lot of ways, and I think that the church has to start saying, not life is hard and then you die, like the t-shirt I wear to exams, or used to wear to exams before my class threatened to lynch me. But life is hard, but in the midst of it there's joy.
You know, an aspect of that I guess is kind of where my process is right now is a realization that life is hard, and that's the way it's intended. But darn it, the idea is I have my head looking better.
Yeah, yeah. If I could only talk to God face to face, and maybe you should read the end of Job and see what that conversation might be like.
There's a lot of arrogance in that. That has to be.
Yeah, and it is very difficult, because there's always some example of out there of how my individual life could be better. Rolan?
So what's the point of going to church?
Because in church, In faith, we find one of the great joys, and that is a relationship with God. A relationship that enables us to forgive ourselves and to forgive those around us. You know, carrying around anger is one of the most destructive things that we can do. Whether it's anger against ourselves or our parents, or in, you know, maybe in my, your case, in mine, the man. You know? Another aside, you've seen this Fox comedy show In Living Color on Sunday nights. There's a character in there which is just the sort of the ultimate angry black man called Homie the Clown. He's what I call a dysfunctional clown who was convinced that everything bad that has ever happened to him is because white people don't want black people to get ahead. Now, in no way do I mean to discount the reality of racism in the United States, but the picture of a clown, someone who chooses to be a clown after he gets out of prison, and then refuses to be a clown for the kids that he gets at the parties he gets hired for. Kids ask him to, you know, throw a banana pie or slip on a banana peel, and he takes a sack that's filled with something we don't know what's in it, and he says, "I don't think so," and he bops the kid on the head and says, "Homie, don't play that." Yeah. Over and over again, and I've got my 2-year-old to say, "Homie, don't play that." But he's so angry that he can't have any fun, even dressed up like a clown. He's so determined to let everybody else run the show for him because he thinks there is a way to do it. And I think that the church frees us, can free us. And in many cases, the church binds us and says, you have to do it this way. But I think when the church works best, it frees us to explore what God has as possibilities for each and every one of us as organisms.
That guy, I think, is a good example of what we could get dragged into, maybe by taking certain aspects of Lutheran theology out of context, too, and that is that life is just agony. And the more agony, the more chances we have of becoming saints, to realize the abundance of God's forgiveness. I think there's an exemplary side to this passage too. You meet people that are just that ready to accept and forgive, that do seem to offer Nancy's and Paul's, who seem somehow to go about life searching for that person that can ultimately accept them, that kind of unquestioned and unreserved love. You know, they just are that accepting. And that, I think, can suggest a way of life that rises above agony. You know, there is such a thing as work that's fun. I don't think I'm ashamed about the fact that I can't wait to go to work in the morning. And I'm a workaholic. Mm-hmm. And I have to strive to make sure that other things in life have their place and aren't squeezed out by that. But, gee, there's a lot to life that's awfully wonderful, too. Mm-hmm. And I think God made it that way. Perhaps that's how God intends it. And there's something terrible that keeps getting in the way of that. But I don't think God intends just your agony.
Yeah. You are happy to go to work because you've chosen your work, and you didn't let someone tell you, I don't know what it was like when you were doing your, but you know, Paul, PhDs in Bible, you know, there aren't any jobs out there.
Where were then?
Okay. Before your generation. But somewhere along the way, you know, maybe somebody, you're not going to make much money or this, whatever somebody tells you about, whatever someone tried to dissuade you or persuade you to another career, there are a lot of us make the choices because someone else told us this. You know, Dad was the carpenter, or Dad did this, or Dad wanted to be a doctor, so you should be a doctor because you've got the rights and the opportunity to be that. When the church enables us to follow the calling rather than to accept someone else's perception of our calling, that's when I think it frees us up. Yes?
Even if we reach complete happiness, then we worry that it won't last, you know?
Yeah.
So,
Why go there?
So why bother? Well, I think the urgency is that while it's there, the reality is it won't last. The urgency is while it's there, enjoy it. Yeah.
Live for the day.
Not only for the day, but for the moment. You know, like that bumper sticker: "Eat dessert first. Life is uncertain." that when you are happy, you know, maybe the example, the two examples from both from the Mediterranean: one Zorba the Greek, and one David before the Ark. You know, if you're happy about it. You know, get up and dance. Don't worry about, oh gosh, how am I going to keep it? Because you're not going to keep it, right? We aren't. I mean, it's life is temporary. Nobody gets out alive, and it's not a dress rehearsal. You know, all of those cliches. You know, but they're cliches. People repeat them because they are true. Jason, I want to get to the last part, the last couple verses here before we leave, with an emphasis. We've been talking about this relationship that won't go away, talking about this forgiveness that is more than we can imagine, and this care for us that is absolutely phenomenal. As we read the next couple of verses, 10 through 13, realize that of the care and the relationship that God has not only with human beings, but also with the rocks and the trees. Can someone finish up the chapter for me?
First the rain and the snow come down from heaven and return not thither that water the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater. So shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose, and prosper in the thing for which I sent it. For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress, instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle, and it shall be to the Lord for a memorial, for an everlasting sign which shall not be cut off.
In this worldview, there continue to be hints that it's especially for us, for human beings. But even as they tell us that, the trees and the mountains, the hills, break forth in the singing, and the trees, when they watch the pine trees sway back and forth, they're clapping their hands. In their way, they are praising God, and they're one more way that we can see God's presence. They are part of the creation, not separate from us, but co-inhabitors with us. That leads me to think that I have a responsibility to be very careful in the choices that I make about how land is used. We have assumed the Earth is about 4 billion years old. Anybody remember when it was created? are any of our Earth scientists here today? Is that the number they're tossing around? Is about 4 billion years. Humans have been around for what do we say now? Our form of human, about 30,000 of those years. We've been sort of organized in the communities for about 7,000 years, about 9,000, 7,000 BC. We've been industrialized for 150. And in those 150 years, we've used up so many of the resources that have been around for 4 billion. Well, yes.
Does this text though say that there is a hierarchy of value? The cypress is worth more than the thorn, the myrtle and the briar.
Yeah, I think I don't think that there's a problem with that.
In other words, it's not suggesting a romanticism where everything, you don't try to control pesticides because the corn beetle, if there's such a thing, is just as valuable as the deer that we see around, etc. Or I'm probably proof texting here, but it seems that sometimes the kind of romanticism that gets carried away with celebrating everything If the cancer cell as much as the healthy cell, it it's not biblically based.
No, but
there's
but
a survival and a tenacity here about life that's viable in a Darwinian universe, though I guess they didn't have Darwin yet. That's also very realistic.
Yeah, but what I would argue though is that we have there are some things about it that we don't know, and we better think long and hard before we say you're not valuable. That I have the right.
You have to be very careful with that.
That I have the right to
translate that into human beings, but just opening a question of whether, you know, that kind of open romanticism is biblically solid either.
Yeah. No, I don't know if you heard at the beginning.